Welcome to the Last Round MMA.
The guy's never beaten me. In order to be the champion, you have to beat the champion.
A podcast for the MMA fan.
Imagine that. Look at everybody up here. They're all dressed like me. They're all trying to talk like me. They're all trying to be me.
Bringing you in-depth interviews and more from across the MMA world.
This is like pride. You know, everybody's here. I feel great. And, you know, I can't wait. Saturday night, I'm going to crush this guy hype.
Are you ready? Let's start the show.
Welcome to the Last Round MMA. Today we have Chris Lights Out Lytel. Thanks for joining me, Chris.
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks.
So no better place to start than at the beginning. So, you know, where did you grow up and how did you get into MMA?
Man, I grew up south side of Indianapolis, which is about 3 hours away from Chicago, just kind of Midwest. I got into fighting, I guess I'd say. You know, I was more of a wrestler. And it's kind of rough when you get done wrestling. There's no like intramural leagues. There's no anything to go to besides Olympics. And that's not a realistic goal for most people. So at the time, I didn't see any UFCs or anything to like UFC 4. And then I was the first one I saw in Dan Severn. And I was like, oh, nobody's going to beat this guy. He's a wrestler. He's just mauling people. He's killing them. And then he fought Royce Gracie in the finals and lost. Like, oh. That's when I first kind of saw what this was. I didn't really think much about it until later because those guys were monsters, you know. And then later on, one of my friends from wrestling, he told me he was doing what he called shoot fighting. I'm like, what is that? He's like, he started describing. I was like, okay, that's that stuff I saw on TV. And so then I started going to the gym. And luckily for me, I was a pretty good wrestler. So, you know, I'm pretty young here and I'm going in. I'm starting to, you know, beat or like, you know, 30-year-old men, like grown men, beards, tattoos, all that. Like, damn, I'm pretty good at this. So then it just kind of built from there. And it was so new. That was back in like early 1998. The sport was still brand new. So you still had a lot of guys who were like, this guy's a kickboxer. This guy's a wrestler. This guy's a jiu-jitsu. I mean, there was a lot of cross-training going on. So very quickly, I decided I needed to do more for my hands. So I started going to a professional boxing gym. And so then I had the ground from wrestling, you know, I got pretty good at like, you know, catch wrestling, and then the boxing really took off. So I was like a step ahead of the game early on.
And how was getting punched in the face for the first time? Because, you know, when you go to a boxing gym, people walk through the door and they look and they be like, you know, that guy is probably going to last like 2 or 3 weeks because it's completely different, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. You know, and it's, you know, I don't care what anybody says. I think it's just kind of something you're either born with or you're not. I mean, you can be toughened up and whatnot, but some people are just, they don't mind being hit. And some people you hit and they become aggressive and they try to hit you harder. And some people do the opposite. They just try not to get hit. I've just figured out that's just something in your DNA and how you are. And I feel like it's how you're born. And fortunately for me, I've never really, I don't say I didn't mind getting hit, but you know, when I get hit, I come forward more and I don't cower away from the punches. I've seen many people come in there like that. It's just, you never know. You learn a lot about somebody the first time you see them spar. And some people, I mean, they can't handle it. And some people, they pass with flying colors and you try and teach them. Eventually, my goal is always to tell people, you don't utilize that toughness. Don't trade punches. You don't want to be the guy who gets hit out. Don't be known that guy can take a beating. That's not a good moniker. You don't want that. You want to use it when you have to, but you don't want to use it all the time. You know what I mean? So, but a lot of people just are built like that. And a lot of people are not. I mean, say what you will. I mean, Brock Lesnar may have been one of the most impressive guys we've ever had in the UFC, but he didn't like to get hit. I mean, that guy gets hit, he folds. He doesn't like, he's a very good hammer, not a good nail. You know, I like the guys who are both. But yeah, there's a lot of guys like him.
So how long after training did the first fight come about? When was that your idea? Was it the coach's idea?
Oh, man, we were chomping at the bit to get out there and fight. This is back in like mid-1998, you know. I mean, the sport is about 4.5 years old. So, you know, just trying to find a place around that would put one on was what we were looking for. And, you know, we would come in the gym every day. Sometimes you go in there twice a day, just what I want to do. And then I heard they had a fight over in Richmond, Indiana. It's over by Ohio. It's like, man, me and my mother, like, let's do it, you know? And sign us up and got us in again, but there was nobody left. And so we went in there and kind of, we went with each other. It was just more of a grappling thing just to get more experience. We weren't really trying to punch each other, but we just, and we wanted to do it as much as we could, you know, try to get in there and fight. And yeah, any opportunity, anywhere, didn't really matter. 3-hour drive, 4-hour drive, we're going.
So your first pro fight was February the 13th, 1999 against Bo. I think it's pronounced Hirschberger.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that pro debut?
Well, to be honest with you, that wasn't my pro debut. That was, you know, back then they didn't really put all the fights on the internet. Even some of the ones they did put on, they came back and took off later because a lot of my fights in the Midwest were unsanctioned, what you'd call, because there was no sanctioning body. I mean, nobody sanctioned the fights until, I don't know, 2008, 2009. So I had probably 15 fights, you know, not all of them before that, but probably 15 to 18 fights that aren't on my record. Unfortunately for me, they were all wins, you know, it's like, and I would say almost all those were pro. And by pro, I mean, I got paid. Like, I don't know what the description between pro and amateur back then, there wasn't much big description. I mean, or difference. It was just like, if you're getting paid, I consider myself a pro. And so I would say Bo Hirschberg, I was 9-0 by the time I fought him. So that was probably my 10th fight. But man, I remember going there. This is funny. My guy who was in charge of my stuff, who kind of ran the gym, who was kind of leader of our group, was a guy named Jason Godsey. He fought in the UFC a couple of times. But I remember he got a hold, called me. He's like, hey, man, I got a fight for you. I'm like, all right. His name's Bo Hirschberg. He's like, he beat Oleg Taktarov in Abu Dhabi. But it's like, Oleg was out on a yacht with the sheiks doing cocaine all day. So it wasn't a big deal. He's not that good. So I was like, all right. So I show up for the fight, and this dude's like 200 pounds. I'm like 173 or something like that. So I'm like, dude, this dude's huge. But I knew he was a ground guy only, so I was like, all right, you know, I'm going to go over there and try and work my stand-up. And I remember I hit him once, and I kicked him. And he, you could just tell he was big and strong, but he didn't have much of a stand-up game. So we tied up, and he pulled guard, and I just sat in his guard for – it was like one 15-minute round or something. I can't remember. But I just sat there and pounded on him the entire time. And it was weird because it was one of those fights where, like – it was like, bring your own gloves. You know what I mean? They didn't provide gloves. So I remember the gloves they had on me, they were like knee pads, but like gloves. It was so weird. And they like taped them on. And so they're just like pillows. But I mean, I remember I was cracking this guy in the head for probably 12 minutes. And at the beginning, I'm in his corner. You can hear his coach, his like cornerman be like, oh, come on, Bo, get up. He hits like a bitch. He hits like a little girl. And after about 5 minutes, like, man, you got to get up. You got to get off your back. He's killing you. So I just beat him up until they finally stopped it, you know. So, yeah, it was a big fight for him because he came out from California with a good team, and they were well-known, and that helped get me over to fight in Pancrase in Japan.
In those early fights, was it all, like, ticket deals? That's how you got paid?
No, I mean, that wasn't in my hometown. I didn't really sell any tickets, man. I think I got $300 for it. You know, I mean, a lot of times that's how it was. So you sold tickets and you made more money, you know, but I mean, that one, I didn't even really sell much. It was only a couple hours away, but I was like, yeah, I don't care. I just want to go there and fight.
And then when you first started, was it frowned upon between your family and friends? Because it was kind of like, it was like an underworld type thing at the beginning, right?
Oh man, people thought you were crazy. You know, when you talk to people and you say you were a case fighter, they just kind of like, you know, and they're like that. Oh yeah, I've seen that stuff. And they'd always kind of take it two steps away. Like you were going to just try and start hitting them or bite them. I don't know what they thought, but they thought you were a lunatic, man. So yeah, the family wasn't real happy with it, man. And they're like, what do you know, they didn't get it. They didn't know why I'd want to do it. Cause you weren't making much money. You know, you're making hardly like a couple hundred bucks, you know, you're in there in the gym all the time, every day for what, a few hundred bucks? And it wasn't even really about the money then. It was just something you want to do. You know, it was just, you love being in the gym. You love being there. You love competing. You love, you know, being able to say, hey, I'm the toughest guy in the gym, or not that, but you know, you, it's hard to explain the fact that when you're like a goal oriented person and, you know when you're fighting, you know what your life's consistent of. Okay, 6 weeks out, 8 weeks out, whatever. I got to do ABC. I have to work out this many times. I've got to eat this style. I got to make this weight on this day. And the next day, I have to compete. I have to do my fight. And, you know, it's your goal. And then you there's order in your life. And you know what you're doing. When that's over, so a lot of fighters just don't. I mean, there's no end game. There's nothing to do. You don't have a date to. You don't have a goal. It's very tough for you. So, you know, I was involved with wrestling. I was involved. I already had this mindset. So all of a sudden, this helped me refocus and gave me something to focus on. It was fighting, you know. So it just made my life make sense. And so, you know, you did it, and you wanted to be the best at it. You want to be getting better, and you want to compete against the best in the world. And it's just kind of how that thing, you know, mentally took over, even though most people thought it was stupid because you weren't making that much money.
Right. One of the other big fights you had earlier in your career is when you fought against Nick Diaz, July 12th, 2002, at IFC 17. What do you remember about that fight?
Man, I remember I wasn't even supposed to fight Nick Diaz. I was supposed to fight Jake Shields, I believe. I think I was supposed to fight him. And I remember they came to me a few days before, and they're like, man, he's out. He has like a staph infection. And I was like, man. So they said, well, we'll see if we can't find you somebody else. So I wasn't even thinking. I thought I probably wouldn't fight. Remember they flew me out to California. I was like, all right, whatever. And like the 2 days before, like, we got a guy. He's a young guy. Hold on. They said he's really good. He's run Grappler's Quest. He's won this and that, but he's young. And I was like, whatever, dude. I'm like, he was only had a couple fights. He's a 20-year-old kid or something. I'm like, I'm going to smoke this guy. And it was, you know, I think I'd already fought in UFC for the first time by then. So I fought in Japan a lot. I'm thinking, I'm fighting this new up-and-comer, whatever. You know, so I remember I went out there, and it was in California. I knew he was from California, but I was like, all right, let's see what we can do here. And I went out there, and it was really hot out that day. I remember how hot it was in the middle of the desert. So I remember the first round, I feel good. I feel like I was winning. And the second round was very close. And I think we both cut each other open. No, I cut him open in the second round. He didn't come in with it. And then third round, I was totally out of gas. And I was dying. And felt like I was winning that round until like about the last 2 minutes. And he cut me open. I was pulled guard and sat on the bottom to the end. I lost the split decision. It was that's painful, man. I remember that was one of the first times in my career I ever thought, man, like, man, I think I was about to quit. I was like, man, what am I doing here? I've been doing this for like 4 years. I'm not making that much money. It's taking a lot of time, energy, effort away from what I'm trying to do. And I'm getting beat by these nobody, young kids. You know what I mean? I'm like, how'd I get beat by somebody who's never done anything? Well, then about a year later, he's in the UFC doing well. So I felt a lot better after that. You know what I mean? Like, when you put everything into perspective, you know, I didn't realize at the time, but I was fighting, you know, one of the best guys out there. I didn't know that. I thought I was fighting some guy who had no business of being in there, and he beat me in a split decision. So it was tough. I mean, it was a pretty fun fight, to be honest with you. I mean, we both did good things. I mean, I remember he was like reverse mount, like north south on me, and I kneed him in the head. So obviously you were allowed to knee in the head back down the ground, and a lot of fun stuff.
Could you tell fighting him that he was, you know, the potential that he had?
Oh yeah. I mean, I can tell. It's like, I mean, that's why I remember thinking, is this sport passing me up already? I mean, I feel like I'm pretty good, but dude, this young guy is, I mean, he threw me in an arm bar and I got out of it. You know, he just, he was good on all positions. I mean, I got a couple of takedowns on him, and, you know, I mean, at the end, he like outlasted me. I mean, I was just trying to hold him down the whole third round, and they stood us up, and I had nothing left, man. And he just came at me then and cut me open, and I pulled guard. I said, damn. It was a close fight, real good fight, but I was like, man, this guy is, I just didn't know how good he was. I thought maybe it was just, you know, I wasn't as good as I thought. And then, you know, a little bit later on, I started saying, okay, this guy's really good. You know what I mean? So then I kind of recognized it. It kind of helped me out think, man, I am still at that level. You know what I mean? So just, you never know, going in there, you find a new young guy and he's good. And yeah, we fought early in our careers, you know.
And it's one of the worst hotels you've ever stayed in on that trip, right?
It was like the Paul Bunyan Motel Lodge Inn or something. It was hilarious. I remember, like, my buddy Alex Stiebling, you know, he fought with me. He was staying in there, too. And, like, I'd go into his room, and, like you couldn't even open the dresser doors. It'd fall apart. And I remember I tried to turn on, like, a light, and I'm flipping the switch. I look underneath there. There's no even, like, light fixture. It's just this lampshade. I mean, this place was one of the worst places I've ever been in, man. It was so funny. I love the old school fight stories because they're all like shitty places like that with just half the promoters would rip you off of me. It was just, it was so funny back then. You just never knew what you were getting. That was kind of, it wasn't funny then, but looking back, stuff's so funny.
Different for people now, I guess, you know, like when people are complaining about the pay in the UFC and you look back at guys like yourself who were kind of like pioneers. And like you said, like it wasn't even a full-time job. You were working and just getting a few hundred bucks at the time, staying in these seedy, terrible, dirty hotels.
Oh, man. Yeah. And I understand it's a different time. It's a different era. It's a different realm. And yeah, I mean, everybody thinks they deserve more pay, which they do. But I mean, I'm on both sides of the spectrum now. You know, I've been places where we're putting on flights. I'm like, you know, you can't pay people what they quote unquote deserve. I remember the last people who really said, we're going to pay you what you deserve. And it was Affliction. And they did. They paid people exactly what they deserved. And they went out of business after two fights because they went bankrupt. You know, I mean, you can't do that. You know what I mean? I remember like one of the fights, you know, I was hear about was I think it was Jay Aron fought Jason High. And it was like the swing bout. Well, it went on after the main event. So it was totally dark fight. They didn't even record it. The confetti is all over the cage. And I think those guys, like, I think that fight cost that organization $50,000. They paid $50,000, like 20 people there to watch, and it didn't do any good for them. So I was like, you can't continually overpay people or pay them what they deserve, because you only deserve what people are going to pay. You know, I mean, you can be the greatest fighter in the world, but if you can't get 50 people to pay to watch you, what are you worth? You know what I mean? So I get all aspects of it, man. I've been on both sides, and you know, everybody deserves a lot of money, but the reality is they can't get it all because organizations aren't going to be there and they're going to go bankrupt, you know? And I understood back then, I mean, you know, I was in a venue that maybe a couple thousand people were there, 1500 people, you know, and you make $800. I mean, I wasn't happy with it, but it was what it was. You know what I mean? I understand now in all aspects that the guy's not going to put on the fight and lose money. That's the stupidest thing ever.
Exactly. Exactly. Turning my attention to the UFC now, the Ultimate Fighter 4, the comeback, this series changed. And instead of having UFC hopefuls, they had a cast of, you know, fighters that have fought in the UFC before but had yet to win a UFC title.
Yeah.
How did you get the call? Like, how did you know how did you get the invitation to come on the show?
I think Joe Silva actually called me and told me about it. And then at one point, Dana White actually called and talked about it, really wanted me on there. And I was like, man, you know, this is going all of a sudden, the contract was going from, you know, making hardly any money, and it was actually paying decent money. So I was like, man, I'm in, you know, this is everything, especially when they talk about the winner got, you know, $100,000, a title fight. And I was like, man, I mean, you had me at $100,000. That's like 10 years worth of fights for me. I was definitely in as soon as I heard that and getting a chance for the title. I mean, that's all you've been working towards for, you know, the past probably 8 years, 7 or 8 years has been with that. So as soon as I heard that, I was in.
And how long away from the family is it from the beginning of the show to the end?
Probably about 7 weeks, you know, and that was pretty tough, man. I mean, I had four kids at the time, and it wasn't just me being gone, but also, I mean, that puts a lot of extra pressure on my wife. You know, she's taking care of four kids by herself for, you know, 2 months virtually. I mean, it was really tough. You know, plus the whole time I was fighting, I was on the Indianapolis Fire Department. So I had to take off work, get a lot of different, had people work for me. It's just really inconvenient for everything. But, you know, you get that opportunity, you're not going to get it all the time. I was really lucky at the time. The chief of the department, I went and talked to him. He's like, well, Chris, you have to take this opportunity. And it's like, if we can't get people to work for you, let me know. I'll come in and work a shift for you. I was like, wow. And when you got people like that who are willing to step up and help you out, that's when you got a good support cast. I was very lucky.
How has been filmed 24/7?
You know, at first it's weird, but after a couple of days, you don't even care. You know, it's like, it was just a little weird. Like, you know, I knew I had four kids and they're going to be watching it. So I was trying to be on a little bit more best behavior than I think if there hadn't been a camera there. But, you know, you're a, you don't even really think about it much. Like, you end up, you put a little thing on so they can hear what you say, and you walk around and you do whatever you normally do. But I mean, you get used to it. I think it really helps doing that. You go through like several years of conditioning for that. And as far as like, you know, how you speak on camera, how you do all that is a skill too, you know, and your ability to do interviews. So I feel like going on that show is like taking 3 years of preparation and put it all in a 6 week period. You just get really good at speaking, and because they pull you to the side all the time and have you do interviews, and there's always a camera in your face. So you get very comfortable with the camera. It just makes it a lot easier for the rest of your career if you're on the show, I believe.
And the coaches, when you were there, were obviously amazing. You had GSP and Randy Couture. So going from kind of being a part-time fighter, because obviously you were working for the fire service, you were full-time for those 7 weeks working with two of the greats.
Oh, man. That's why, you know, I remember being on the show. I remember I developed a friendship with Matt Serra, and I remember me and him, a couple of the people sitting there talking. And some people were complaining, oh, I don't have my phone. I want my radio. I want to be home. And I was thinking, we were like, man, I mean, this is as good of a chance. It's the only time really in my career I ever got to train full time. You know, I loved it. You know, I was in there with great coaches and great training partners. I mean, I was like, there's nowhere else I'd rather be. I don't care if I ever have a phone again or a TV. I don't care about those things. I want to be here training and fighting, getting better, going with some of the best guys in the world. It was, you know, I still, now I have certain things I show other fighters, like training wise and whatnot, about how to do things that I learned from Randy and a GSP, you know, just workouts and different plyometric things. It's like, man, these, trust me, these work, you know, I learned these from some of the best. And, I'd never really done plyometric workouts before I went on the show. People thought it was crazy. Like, man, how do you win any fights in the UFC not doing this stuff? I was like, I don't know. It's what I do, man. I'm like more of the old school Rocky IV, or like lifting up rocks and snow and stuff. I don't know. So it's just a different experience. But they were great. Randy was funny because he was one of those guys. All the guys respected him so much. He could have probably said, okay, you guys go swim across that river full of alligators. We'd have been like, all right. You know, I mean, we would have probably done it anyway, just because, like, you don't say no to Randy. Nobody really wanted to, because everybody just looked up to him in a way. So it was kind of cool seeing that in that room full of high-level UFC fighters. He was still, you know, commanded respect. It was pretty cool. He didn't have to ask for it. He was just giving it because of who he was and what he's done. It was awesome.
Had you watched the previous three seasons?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, I did like the fact that it had changed. You know, the first two, they're doing all these competitions and weird stuff that had nothing to do with fight. I was so glad after they stopped doing that. I was like, yeah, I'm not doing that stuff. You know what I mean? So I don't understand you're going to hurt yourself doing that. I liked that the way they had it. We're like, hey, whoever wins stays in control. My team stayed in control pretty much the whole time. It was good for us. I bet the other team would probably differ. They'd probably say it'd be better to do it another way, but.
The Ultimate Fighter really changed the landscape of the UFC. It really took it onto another level.
Without a doubt. I mean, people don't understand. I mean, you know, at one point, the UFC is about 45,000, a million in debt. And I look back at it, you know, people like myself ask, I need more money, I need more money. It's like, man, no, you don't. You know, I mean, we're losing tons of money here. It took the Ultimate Fighter to get people to watch him on a weekly basis and to get to know the fighters and their stories and to actually care about him. Like, these aren't who you think they are when you just watch a fight. Like, they have backstories, they have family issues, they're just putting so much of their life online to come out here and put on these fights. Really got people engaged and cared about him, and really, like I said, changed the landscape, because all of a sudden it was mainstream. You know, it wasn't before. Like you said, it wasn't the fact where people looking at you like, oh, you fight in the cage. Like, they look at you like you had two heads. You know what I mean? Like, you were, something's wrong with you. But then all of a sudden they appreciate it and they go, okay, these guys are athletes. Mm. You know, I mean, some of the other athletes already got it back then. But now, I mean, now a lot of other regular people got how hard people work, what they did. And so that was a game changer, man. Once they got people to pay attention to, get vested in the story, you know, then it was game on. And then people, you know, the number of people watching just grew exponentially. And another smart thing UFC did at that point was they started trying to find people from different countries. So you get the, you know, Alexander Gustafsson, you know, now Sweden likes it. And you get a guy from Russia, now Russia likes it. Now you get a guy from, I mean, you got a guy from, you know, each different, you know, corners of the globe. And then all of a sudden, it has global appeal. I always tell people there's only two sports that I know of that have global appeal: soccer and fighting. I mean, American football, no. Baseball, cricket, no. I mean, any of these things, people, they have their area and they might be super popular. soccer worldwide and some form of combative sports fighting is global. So once they went that route, I mean, man, you got, you know, 7 or 8 billion people, probably good game plan to go global if you can.
I know you kind of touched on that you were on your best behavior whilst you're in the house, but did you ever worry that the way that they cut and format the show can kind of make you look good or make you look bad? And did you worry about coming outside as like a villain?
No, man. I mean, we were pretty fortunate on that show. Everybody was pretty mature. You know what I mean? It's not like some of these where you got people peeing on people's food or doing whatever. So, I mean, everybody was really cool. We were there to fight. And I kind of got the impression just going there, you know, we had Shoney Carter, and I could tell just his antics, he was doing certain things. We're like, oh, they're definitely going to be all over this. You know, they're going to be focusing on him, what he was doing. He wasn't being a bad guy. He was just being kind of a clown. So, and infuriating the other team. And I knew, you know, Matt Sarah, like I said, one of my buddies, but he was very loud, vocal about a lot of things. So, you figured he was going to be kind of the focus quite a bit, but I mean, you can't really worry about that. You just got to go out there and try and act how you're going to be. I did feel a little worse for my buddy Mitrione. He was on there and got a little mislabeled a little bit, but there was a lot that went with that one too. So,
like you said, that your team kind of kept in control of the fights the whole time. Did you and Matt have a feeling that you were going to end up in the final together?
That was definitely a thought. I mean, I knew going in, you know, tough room. I mean, a lot of tough fighters in there. And it just kind of depended on how they were going to match us up at the end. I thought it'd be either me and Matt or me and Dean Thomas. You know, it's kind of my thought from what I saw, is like, man, because Dean, unbelievably good, unbelievably skilled. I don't think he really ever got the credit he deserved, but man, really slick on his feet, really good on the ground. So I know he's going to be tough for anybody.
You defeated Pete Spratt by submission and then defeated Din Thomas. And then in the final, November 11th, 2006, at the Hard Rock Casino in Las Vegas, you fought Matt Serra. What can you remember about that fight?
Oh, I remember it was probably one of the worst fights you're going to see, man. It was very, very boring, I believe. You know, looking at that fight, I don't wish what they did really on my worst enemy, man. It was very too much was built up for that one fight. The winner, like I said, they came out then at the end and said, basically, you get $100,000 sponsorship, $100,000 prize, you know, a car, a watch, a title fight. You get, you know, $250,000 worth of stuff. The loser gets basically nothing. And so it was a lot of pressure on that. You know, I won the title. At one of that title shot. So we both went out there, I feel like, not even to win, just trying to not lose. Yeah. I went out there and I thought the whole time, like, if he can't take me down, he's not beat. You know, I know he needs to get me to the ground. I'm going to out, you know, I can outland him on punches. And then, you know, how the fight went, he's thinking, I got to get this guy to the ground. And so he went out there and just kind of, whenever we tie up, you know, he kind of pushed me into the fence. I remember, in my head, I'm thinking, okay, my back's against the fence, but I'm landing little punches here, and he's trying to take me down. I'm defending the takedown, and I'm landing little punches. He's not really landing any punches. So I was like, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm only doing like 2 damage on him, but he's doing 0 to me. So I was like, I'm winning. I had no problem going, put my back to the fence. Every time we tap, I'm like, cool, let's go back here instead. And I know in his head, he's thinking, I got his back to the fence, so I'm winning. I didn't see it like that. I thought I'm doing more damage than him. Come to find out at the end, like, it was funny because I don't think I've ever seen this before, but, you know, one of the judges gave him all 3 rounds. The next gave me all 3 rounds. And the third one gave it all 3 to him. So I'm like, I've never seen a split decision where, like, all 3 rounds were different. You know what I mean? Like, it's just a weird way. It just shows me they didn't really know how to score it either, because it wasn't a good fight, man. It was boring, but like neither one of us cared how boring that fight was. It's like, I have to win at all costs. That was both of our mindset. But like after that fight, you know, I mean, I was bummed, man. I was just like, there's nothing like not fighting the way you want. And then you lose a decision on top of it. I got nothing out of it. I didn't get the money. I didn't get the title fight. I didn't even get the enjoyment of knowing I went out there and fought my fight. So remember eventually I was like, you know what? I'm not, I'm never going to try and win a decision again. I'm just never going to sell out and try and win like that. Just, no matter what happens, I'm going to try and knock you out or submit you. That's all I care about. And if I don't, hey, whatever, man. Then I feel like I probably lost if I don't do it, but I'm just going to go out there and try and take you out. And after that, you know, I was able to win 10 bonuses. You know, I won fight of the night, sub of the night, you know, knockout. I won all that stuff because I always felt like, man, I've lost bigger fights than this. Pressure's off me. I can just go out and fight. And it really helped me, not only with that, but I think it helped me in everything. Like, I feel like no matter what, if I get in a position where I lose everything, I'm still going to keep coming back and I'm going to win at some point. You know, I'm going to win the way I want to. Now, I'm not going to compromise what I'm going to do. I'm going to do it my way and I'm going to win at some point, one way or the other, because I won in the sense where I won a lot more money and everything by the win all those bonuses than I ever would have if I'd have won that fight. So, you know, the goal really wasn't necessarily just to win money, but that was definitely a goal for the family, you know. So I felt like I was able to accomplish that, and, you know, made a lot more fans and everything like that by continuing to change my style and fight the way I wanted to. I have no problems the way it turned out. You know, I'm glad for me. I'm glad for Matt Sarah. I'm glad for everybody. But like I said, he's still one of my buddies. I'm glad he was able to go out there and shock the world. It was awesome.
Did it make it harder for you when you, after the fight, and you looked in like Sherdog, Fight Metric, all had you winning?
Yeah, I mean, it was very painful, man. I mean, like I said, looking back, you know, I get it a little bit. That's, you know, if your back's against there and they're controlling, has somewhat to do. I mean, to me, still, if a guy's, whoever's doing the most damage is winning the fight. That's the way I've always thought. I still think that way. I don't think any of us were doing much damage. It was not a good fight. Like I said, he had his game plan to hold me against the fence. I had mine of hitting him little, not doing much damage, but doing some. It was just a tough fight to judge, you know, and I'm just mad at myself for trying to win a decision. I'm mad at myself for leaving it to the judges, man. You put three guys who've never had a fight in their life and you're going to let them decide how a fight goes. You get what's coming to you. You know what I mean? So I am a little disappointed in that, but that's why I don't ever think, man, putting that kind of, you know, pressure. There was guys who, you know, lost their first fight in the Ultimate Fighter house who made more money than me. They came on that, you know, the finale and they won their fight and they made more money than me. I'm like, how can that be possible, man? How can they lose right away and make a lot more money than me? I was like, I got second. I don't think they should ever put that kind of all or nothing winning on there. I don't like that, man. Cause man, how bad that, you're not going to get guys put on good fights. And I understand. Now, think about it. When have you ever seen like a title elimination fight? Whoever wins this fight gets a title. Very rare is it a good fight. You know what I mean? Usually they're kind of boring because people like, they got too much on the line, too much pressure. Very rare when those are the best fights. So I understand that. And it's unfortunate. But I mean, you know, yeah, it was very painful for many, many months for me trying to deal with that. And, I don't know. That's when I had to just give up and say, man, I'm not fighting like that ever again. Like, even if I lose another fight, I'll do it on my terms. But like, I can't went out there and try to take the guy out. I didn't do it. So whatever. I went out my way. That was my thought, you know, because I'm not going to try and win a boring decision and then not have, there's not one positive aspect. At least if I go out there and try and take you out, I can say, hey man, I fought my fight. I didn't win, whatever. And you know, I didn't win every fight after that. I lost them, but none of them were stupid fights that I should like put on a boring fight. I don't think I ever put on a boring fight again after that.
Matt Serra would go on to fight and actually beat GSP at UFC 69 for the UFC welterweight title. Did you watch that fight?
Of course, man, of course.
And how did that make you feel watching someone that you lost a controversial split decision to actually go on and get the UFC gold?
I mean, man, I was extremely happy for Matt. Like I said, none of this had anything to do with me being not, I mean, he's a great guy, one of my good buddies, man. I was so happy for him winning that, you know. You know, it wasn't until I remember I was driving home and it was, you know, where I started thinking, man, that could have been me. You know what I mean? It could be me in there knocking out St. Pierre wearing that belt. And then it kind of started hitting. I was like, man, the pain came back a little bit more, but I was definitely happy for him, man. He deserved it. He's a great guy, and it changed his life, so I was happy for him.
You eventually got revenge on Matt Serra in a rematch September 25th, 2010 at UFC 119 on the undercard of Frank Mir and Crow Cop.
Yeah.
how long was that in the works? And obviously, your friends with Matt, did you guys talk about it and have a bit of banter for a while?
Nah, man, it really bothered me about that was, like, I never even really want to do that fight again, to be honest with you. I was like, I thought the first fight was boring, you know what I mean? Like, and I was like, man, that wasn't a good first fight. And I know Matt's really skilled, especially on the ground. So I was like, man, if I try to open up against him, it's going to be tough because that opens up the takedown. So, and mind me, the style I was going out there, I was just like reckless abandonment. I was going out there trying to take people's heads off or submit them or whatever. And I'm like, I don't know if this is going to be a good fight again. So I was like, whatever. I never asked for that once. And then, you know, Matt told me later on that, you know, Joe Silva started telling him, Chris has been begging for this fight for years. I was like, man, that bothered me because I was like, I never asked for this fight once, but it made me feel like a dick. Like I'm going behind my friend's back asking to fight him, which wasn't true. So he's like, I mean, the point is if the UFC tells me to fight somebody, I'm going to fight him. I don't care who it is, no matter what, but don't make it like I was begging for the fight. That bothered me, you know? So I talked to Matt about that. I was like, man, I never asked for this fight. You know, I didn't want this fight, but we did it. We fought, you know. He felt like if he could knock me out, he'd get right back in title contention. That's what he had to do. So he fought me on my feet, and it was a good fight, man. It was funny. He's tough as nails. Like I said, he's hard to finish, man. He's a tough guy.
Did you feel like you'd righted a wrong, or had that kind of gone?
Not really. I mean, I just felt like almost like, why didn't you do that the first time? You know, if you do that the first time, you're like, you might have got that title fight. So it was almost bittersweet. It's like, yeah, you got the win, but you should have done that the first time, you idiot, and fought. But, you know, it is what it is, man. Like I said, I never really take pleasure in fighting a buddy. You know, I've had to do it several times, and you do it. But, I mean, you know, no, I didn't really feel like – I definitely felt bad after the first fight. Like, that was the worst – little experience when it comes to fighting. That was the lowest of the lows that I've ever had, you know, when it comes to fighting. And did that, I mean, was that high really good when I beat him? Absolutely. But I mean, it didn't make up for the low, you know. That low was just, it's always going to be in the back of my head. I always remember that, you know. I always remember how bad that made me feel and how much that made me work harder. You know what I mean? When I was in the gym training for fights, I was like, never going to feel like that again because you're tired or something, because you didn't work hard. I was like, I just can't let that happen, man. I'm going to utilize that negative stuff that happened in my life to push me forward and push me to do hard, work harder, man. And I try and talk to kids about that, about when negative stuff happens, you can let it destroy you, or you can help use that for fuel to make you better, you know? And that's what it did for me, man. It made me want to work harder and just never, I didn't want anybody to outwork me at the gym. I just wanted to work harder than anybody and try as hard as I could, man. What else can you do? I mean, I know I'm not the most athletic or the strongest or the fastest, but I mean, I don't think you're going to outwork me. I'm going to go out there and outwork you as hard as I can every day. That's the only thing I really know how to do.
How do you practice controlling that anger in a fight so you don't just try to, you know, like swing windmills, you know, just try and knock them out and like kind of, because obviously you see the gamesmanship before a fight, kind of like, oh, Aldo and Conor McGregor is probably a really good example, because Aldo just came forward and walked straight into that.
Mad.
Yeah.
That's the thing, man. You have to, and I think most of that is just, you know, experience being professional. I mean, you get 80 to 100 fights, man. Yeah, you learn that. You know, you learn, all right, you can say whatever you want, you can do whatever, but I'm still going to be here to fight you. And can't get emotional about it. You know, emotion is a great thing in many things. Not in fighting. It's the worst thing in fighting. You get emotional, you get sloppy. So no matter what is being said, you just have to, you know, keep your mind. Mental toughness is the best thing you can have in fighting or any sport, in my opinion. But I mean, you have to be mentally tough if you would be good at this sport. Really good. And just, you know, just, I'm not really sure how you can, I'm not sure how you can work on mental toughness. I think you either have that or you don't, you know. Basically, you can develop it based on what's happened in your life, I think, but some people never can develop it. I think, you know, most people I see are just like very mentally tough, and they're not. I don't know, you can see it when they're a little kid by how they react to adversity. I don't know if that's just something in your DNA or something that happens as you grow up, but maybe it's a combination of both. I'm not real sure about that, but I feel like the best thing you can do is just be a mentally tough fighter, and then you're going to be, you know, zoned in, and you're not going to let people rattle your cage. I mean, There's a few fighters who I think fight better when they're angry. I think George St. Pierre is one of them. I think he gets more focus. I mean, look at his fights when, like first time he fought Matt Serra, very respectful, both guys, didn't do well. And then when he fought, like, Jake Shields, very respectful, he didn't do well. Look how he fought against Koscheck, who talked a lot of trash. He thumped him. Or anybody who talked a lot of trash to St. Pierre, he thumped him. He got more focus, and he was better. Some guys get out of control when you talk trash to them. Like you just talked about, Jose Aldo ran at Conor McGregor, got knocked out. So knowing your opponent is big and whether you should talk trash. I mean, you know, some people just talk trash no matter what. Well, then you're like when Conor did against Khabib, you don't talk. I mean, that was the worst thing to do against Khabib. You pissed him off and he's focused and he's mentally tough and he got in there and beat the brakes off him. So knowing your opponent is one thing, just understanding who you should talk trash to, who you should get out of their element, who's going to fight better. Those are all big deals.
How is it for you when you're getting your hands wrapped, knowing it's now time for war?
Well, it's probably the worst time. I don't care what any fighter says, man. That when you show up to the venue, you know, when you show up to that arena, and when you're in a locker room, that's the worst time. That's when all those feelings in your head, you know, and those thoughts in your head really start coming out. You start questioning everything. Like, how did you work hard enough? But I mean, you know, there's going to be several million people watching. That's when you start, you know, man, I don't want to be on this guy's highlight reel, me getting horribly knocked out or some crazy submission or just being dominant. And like, you just, that stuff starts going through your head about all the things negative that could happen, man. And you just, you know how hard you've worked and you know your ability, but that doesn't always be put on display like you want it to. I mean, a lot of times, all I'm really trying to focus on there is doing what I have to do to try and go out there and put out the best version of me. I can't control what that guy's going to do. I can control what I'm going to do. Go out there and be ready, be quick, be explosive, be ready to try and take somebody out. If they get you to move, work, be calm and get out, you know, work for your own submission. Just going through everything in your head you need to. But yeah, that's the worst time is when everything is going through your head. I don't care who you are. You're thinking about negative possibilities.
Are you superstitious? Do you have anything that you have to do before a fight?
No. Not really. I mean, I think like it's funny. Like every day of fight day, I would go and eat breakfast, but I really couldn't eat. I probably eat a protein bar later on, but I couldn't eat. You know what I mean? Like, not that I didn't believe it, not that I thought, well, I did this last time, I didn't, and I won. But it's just like, man, like my body, it was weird. Like, I feel like my body would subconsciously do a lot to get me ready for the fight. You know, like I remember one fight. You know, my left shoulder and my arm was messed up, and I couldn't really throw a jab. I'm thinking, I'm going to have to back out of this fight. I can't do it. And like 2 days before the fight, everything got better, you know, and then 2 days after the fight, it all fell apart again. I think I just like willed myself subconsciously to do it. After a fight, like for the next 2 to 3 days, I can't eat well. I can't sleep well. Like all that energy and negative or like nerves is in my body, but like I never really felt it. Like I just, I'd have a fight, it'd be fine. And then afterwards, I think subconsciously, I blocked all that out, all the nerves, all the stuff until like, you know, you get in the locker room. But then like after the fight, all that comes out and you know, I couldn't eat, I couldn't drink. Like it took me a couple of days just to like decompress. And I think I was just my body like, man, I can't, you know, you were under stress and you didn't even realize it, Chris, you know, and I was like, oh, okay. And so, those aren't really rituals, but those are things that would happen every fight.
You get your hands wrapped, you do a little warm-up, and then obviously the curtain call goes and it's your time to walk. What is that like? Because there's only a very small percentage of people in the world that have experienced that.
Man, to be honest with you, by that time, it's on. Like I'm ready at that point. Like I didn't get nervous at all walking to the cage. You know, by the time I'm out there, like right before, by the time you walk out and they're getting ready, I'm already zoned in. I'm mentally there. I'm ready to go. And so, like, I wanted to get in the ring as fast as possible in the cage. So, like, I would just walk straight there, take my stuff off, throw it down, not hugging my coaches, not hugging my people. I already did that in the back. That's not what this is about. I don't need to make a spectacle. I'm ready to fight. So, I'd always just go out there and try and get in the cage, get the octagon as soon as possible, go out there and just I'm ready to go. At that point, I just want to get this. I've been building up for this for probably 2 months. It's time. Let's get in there. So at that point, all the nerves were gone. I mean, even when like you're written right there and after your name, I mean, the nerves weren't there anymore. Some people say they still have the nerves. I have the nerves in the back in the locker room, not out there when you're getting ready to fight.
Has there ever been a time where you walk to the ring and maybe not, because we kind of touched on like, you know, have been mentally tough, but has there been a time when you've walked to the ring and you've had a bad camp and in your head, you're kind of thinking, man, I missed that run and, you know, my timing was off, and you've kind of like mentally kind of fucked yourself, I guess.
No, not really, man. I mean, like only time I probably should have was when a couple of fights, I think I probably had two fights where that was like last minute replacements. And like I said, one was that Nick Diaz fight. And then one where I fought that Pat Healy, like he wasn't supposed to fight. And then he took it like on a 2 days notice or something. Like, oh, they did get somebody. And then, I totally gassed out in the third round. Like one of the first two rounds I was gassed out because I mentally wasn't prepared for it. Like I thought the fight wasn't going to happen. Didn't train hard for the last, week. And then I didn't do what I should have. So I probably should have thought that then, but I remember I saw like Pat Healy's record. He was like 11-7. I was like, who's this? Wasn't you like the day before I looked in who those seven losses were, and half of them were like UFC veterans. I was thinking, this guy's pretty tough. But I still didn't even put two and two together until I got in there with them and fought. I was like, man, this guy, I cannot put him away, man. I was killing him the first two rounds, but I couldn't stop him, man. So I probably should have thought that then, but I didn't. I thought, I'm going to go in there and smoke this guy. So you think that, seeing it's always amazing to me as a fighter how many times you've seen it time and time again, a guy gets beat by somebody when they get overconfident or just thinking they can't lose this guy. And it happens all the time. Like, how can you ever get overconfident? Well, you do as a fighter. It's weird. You wouldn't think you would. You think you'd learn from experience and watching other people. No, it's always going to happen. People, you have to be in a way delusional, in my opinion, to be a good fighter, to be thinking no matter what happens, you're the best guy in the world. I mean, I can beat this guy. I can beat that guy. And you can lose a fight, and the next fight, you got to be thinking, I'm the best guy in the world. I'm not sure how you continue to keep fighting if you don't think you can beat anybody and you can beat everybody, So I always have to have that level of delusionalness, even though it's not true. I feel if you want to be a really good fighter. And I never let that creep into my head that, man, maybe I didn't do enough, because I always try to do as much as humanly possible. I never thought like that.
What's the process, Chris, of, getting offered a fight by the UFC? Do they call you? Do they call the manager? Does it pop up on an email?
Usually, but always, well, I had both experience. I had them calling me and I had them call my manager. Just depends who your manager is and everything. And usually they'd call towards the last, probably, 15 fights of my career, they always call my manager and talk to him, and he'd call me and say, and as soon as he'd call, I'd usually be like, all right, man, we got an appearance or we got a fight coming up. And he'd tell me, they want you to fight this. I'm like, yeah, all right. Here's a weird thing. Like, I don't think I ever really said no whenever they asked me. So it was always kind of like, all right. I mean, you're not really good back then. At least you weren't even in a good position to bargain with UFC. Like, this is who they want you to fight. Like, all right, let's do it. Once again, I had that delusional thought. I was like, I can beat anybody, so whoever they put in there with me, I have guys I'd rather fight more than others. I was one of the guys who were going to come in and fight, try and take me out. I think if you're going to try and take me, I'm going to take you out. I want guys who are going to try and eke out a decision, because it takes two to make a good fight. And I think if you put me in a good fight, I'm going to put on a great fight, and I feel like I'm going to win. But if you put me on a boring fight or the other guys that try to make it boring, not only is it going to be hard to win, but it's going to be a boring fight. And I don't want to be in a boring fight. So I always kind of ask for – I don't care who it is. Let's make sure they come to fight.
Do you still like the fight and win bonus? Or do you think it should just be a flat fee now?
Terrible, man. It just should be a flat fee, because, I mean, there's nothing like I said, man, you go out there and you do everything you're supposed to. Let's say you lose a split decision, because one judge thought you didn't do enough. All of a sudden you get half your money. I mean, that's not right. It can be a lot of significant money based on one person's opinion, and I don't like that. So you go out there and you do everything you're supposed to do. You put on a great, that's why I love the fact that they gave that Burns his win bonus, because he went out there and fought like he should have, but half the people on the card probably fought the way they should have, and they're not getting their win bonus. So it's rough to depend on that and then you don't get it. I like the boxing style where you go in there and this is what you're going to get paid, win, lose, or draw, you fight and you get it. Now, it affects you next time. You know what I mean? Like, okay, you fight like this, we're not going to keep giving you this kind of fight. We're not going to give you these bonuses. We're not going to give you, you know, good fights. And then your next contract might suck. But, you know, that contract, it doesn't – everybody's trying as hard as they can. It doesn't incentivize them to fight harder. I mean, bonuses, you know, fight the night, some of that incentivizes them. You don't need two sets of incentive. First of all, you get your win bonus, and second of all, everybody's out there trying as hard as they can. I don't think it's fair to take away half their money.
And something I've always thought about is, depending on what you get, say you get 25,000 in California, it's not a lot of money. But 25,000 in another state can be actually quite a lot of money, or in the UK, like Paddy, like with the money that he got, that's not a bad amount in the UK. But if you live in like somewhere expensive, like New York or California, it's not that much money.
Exactly. You know what I mean? So, and they don't really care. They don't take that into consideration. You know, it's just, it is what it is, man. Hey, move somewhere else if you want to get, you know, I mean, hell, incentive right there for people to move to Florida, in my opinion. You know, you got California got the most expensive state income tax in the country. Florida has zero state income tax. So maybe that's why they got so many damn good fighters out there, all kinds of good fighters moving out of Florida. So tough down in Southern Florida. I mean, even Northern, I mean, just Florida's tough. But I wonder if that has something to do with it, because, man, if I'm making 25 grand a year and I'm having to give that much to not only federal government, a high percentage of state, that ain't going to work.
No, exactly. UFC Live 5, Dan Hardy against yourself, August 4th, 2011.
Yeah.
A big day for you. You'd won 5 out of 6 fights, but before the fight, you decided to tell everybody that this was going to be your last one and you were going to retire. Can you let us into why, Chris?
Man, okay, so my fight before that, you know, I'd hurt my knee, had knee surgery, but I didn't really rehab it. So after the fight, I rehabbed it. Actually stayed home for a few weeks, didn't go to the gym. Like, I never missed the gym, man. I felt like I wasn't in a real camp, but I wasn't like a place where they're training all the time, like other camps, and wasn't with the greatest, you know, camp. So I figured, man, I gotta outwork everybody. So I'm like, I'm never missing. I'm never getting out of shape. So I'm 4 kids and you have kids and you're missing some gymnastics meets and some basketball games. And I miss a lot of stuff. So I go to the gym. I stop going to the gym for a couple of weeks and I go to some basketball games and I go to some cheerleading things. I'm just, you know, I start feeling a lot of guilt about, you know, my kids are getting older, you know, and my son, I think, was a freshman in high school. I'm like, man, you know, I talked to a guy who was telling me how he really wanted to be successful to help his daughter and work so much. Next thing you knew, she was in college. She's like, man, I missed my daughter's life. I didn't really know her. And so then I started seeing that was going to be me. You know, I was like, what good does it do if you've made money for your kids if you don't know how they did in basketball? And if you don't go to their games, but I could, you know, I was gone. So, you know, I went to the gym after that. They signed me for that Dan Hardy fight. And the first time ever, I felt like I didn't want to go to the gym. You know, I was like, I shouldn't be going here. And that was a problem. I was like, man, I can't. How can you train if you don't want to be there? And it's never happened before. And so I still wanted to fight. I just didn't. I felt guilty. So I remember I went over after that day at the gym. I went home and I kind of talked to my wife about it. And I was just like, it's going to be it. You know, it's going to be my last fight, but I'm not going out with the loss. So that gave me the freedom to go to the gym every day. And then ever since then, I was excited to go back to the gym. It's like, I got to be here. I got to do to win this fight. And so that was kind of what it was about. I was like, I got to be home more, man. I just got to be around the family more. And so, I mean, you know, working full time and at the firehouse and then trying to train, it just something had to give, you know? And so that's what had to be the fighting.
And I think I'm right in saying you wrote a letter and then at the weigh-ins, you handed one to Dana and one to matchmaker Joe Silva.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I wanted to let them know why I was going to be my last fight and just, explain to them, you know, how much, you know, what they've been able to do for me has helped change the life of me and my family. You know, it's like my wife didn't have to work the whole time. I fought, you know, she was home taking care of kids for 12, 13 years. You know what I mean? Most people don't get that. Mm-hmm. I was able to maintain that for everybody. And, you know, it was them changing. Like, I was there before they bought the UFC, you know, and I was there when SEG did. And I was like, this isn't going to make it. This sport is here. And how much time, energy, effort. I mean, their life was consumed with that sport, you know, and if they hadn't went out and done that, would any of us be here? Probably not. So, you know, I had to thank them for not only that, but giving me the opportunity to go out there and you know, do what I do, put on my display, put on my skin. Like I said, Joe was very accommodative when I'd say, hey, man, just give me somebody to fight. I don't care who it is. If they want to come out there and bang and, or try to move me, I'd love to fight those guys. And he was very good. That's why I was able to win 10 bonuses, because he put me in there with the right kind of people who were going to come to fight. That's all I asked for him. So I thanked him for that. I thank Dana for the opportunity, and it's like, this is why I'm doing it, and I appreciate it, you know. So I think that's, you know, I think they deserve that. You know, I was one of their guys, and I still had, like I said, felt like I was peaking, you know, won 5 out of my last 6 fights. Mm-hmm. I was doing great. I was ready to make a run, but I was like, man, I can't do it if my head's messed up out, you know, missing my family and not being around. I can't do everything. Like, I wish I could, but I can't.
Was there a difference? We just talked about, you know, being in the locker room. Was there a difference in there? Was there kind of like a peace or tranquility because you knew this was going to be your last one?
I mean, kind of quite the opposite. It was like, not only was it like, this is going to be it, you know, you kind of miss it, but then at the same time, like, man, I want to lose my last fight. You know, I was like, I got to win my last fight. I knew enough, you know, from being involved with wrestling, everything else, like how you end your career is how you're going to think about your career the rest of your life. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm hoping I'm going to live a long, you know, life, not, you know, a couple of years later. So I'm like, you better have positive thought process. I don't know many people in the sport that think good about, I mean, it's always that last fight that leaves a sour taste in your mouth. So I was like, man, I got to go out here. That had like, I don't know. I've seen people who fight and they win and they, or whatever, then they retire, or they fight and they lose, they retire. I didn't know too many people who had announced it beforehand. And I didn't realize, you know, it was going to put a lot more pressure on me. But I was like, man, I had to tell them, and, you know, I got to go out here and win. I mean, there was just no option. I had to win so I could sleep at night, every night, knowing that, man, I did it my way the whole time. I went out the way I wanted, you know. So I felt like there was more pressure on me than ever. Oh, now that too. So we're in Milwaukee. Harley-Davidson is a sponsor. And so they had me and Dan Hardy out doing some promotional stuff, you know, sitting on some of the motorcycles and taking pictures. And I'm talking loud to the Harley execs. I'm thinking, oh, man, you need to give the two guys in the main event a Harley. You need to have them each ride their own Harley doing promotional stuff for you guys. Oh, if I were you, that's what I would do to get a lot of publicity out of this. I kept saying this stuff like that. They're kind of laughing. I'm like, man, I'm serious. You need to give these guys, oh, that's me. You need to give us Harleys and we'll drive around. So the day of the fight, I get a phone call like, Chris, I think they're going to give the winner of the fight a Harley. I'm like, God dang it. Now I got to win even more. So then, can you put more stuff on here? Can you put more on the plate? My last fight, whatever. Now the Harley. So it was cool.
You were retired for 7 years and then came back in the bare knuckle. During that time, was there any fights offered to you by the UFC? Did you ever get kind of itchy fingers to come back?
I definitely got some itchy fingers to come back, you know. You know, luckily or unluckily, I would say, I was able to work it out. Like before, every time I trained, it'd be at night, you know, we had to wait about 5 o'clock at night. Everybody showed up at the gym. But at this point, a little bit later, started getting it where people were coming in a little during the day. So I was like, man, I could do it when my kids were, I could train a little bit while my kids were at school. You know what I mean? So it made it a little bit different, but I remember at one point, I was talking with my buddy, Amitron, and I'm in my early 40s at this point. He's like, man, he's like, Chris, do you really think you could come in and train 5 days in a row? Like, I don't know. I went in a couple of days in a row, and I was like, man, unless I'm willing to do a bunch of growth hormone or testosterone, I was like, it's not. And that's why people fail tests. It's not because you want to be bigger, stronger, faster. So you can't get through a training camp. Like, only way I know how to train, maybe you could if you were smarter about how you do it. But like, man, I'm an old school guy. I go in and go hard every day. Just train hard, hard, hard. And I can do that. I can get by. I can do it 6 days a week, you know, no problem. I can't do it anymore. I couldn't do it at this point, man. It's like, if you get hurt and you like, I could probably go in there. I was told people I'd take a fight. If the other guy would promise he wasn't going to train every day like me. Like, if we're both last minute knows, I would do that. I would have done it in a heartbeat, but I can't go in there. I can't train the way I wanted to. So I was like, man, I'm just going to hurt myself or go and embarrass myself just because, like, it's too tough on your body physically. When I came out and did bare knuckle, that's one of the reasons I did. I was like, dude, two hands, all I had to do was go in there, hit mitts, do some sparring, jump rope. I could do that, man. I could definitely get through a camp. But that's the first quarter of your practice when you do MMA. Then you got wrestling, grappling, jiu-jitsu, kickboxing. I mean, it's so much harder to do MMA fight than bare knuckle. And so, you know, the whole thought of doing bare knuckle was great, but MMA, no, man, that's just that passed up my body long ago.
Did the bare knuckle promoters, did they approach you about coming out of retirement for the fight?
Well, actually, the funny thing was I fought over in England first and they didn't come to me. I remember I saw on Facebook, it's like Joe Riggs does bare knuckle fight in London. I was like, what the hell is wrong with Joe, man? I thought he's going to be in some warehouse with like bales of hay around him. So I hit play. I started watching. About halfway through the second round, I looked over the guys like, how do you think I could get a hold of these guys? Like immediately I changed my tune. Like, this isn't what I thought. You know, I thought this was going to be, like I said, two guys in a warehouse just throwing haymakers. It was very measured. It was very controlled. It was a sport. And I was like, man, I got to try this. So I eventually got a hold of the guys in Europe, England. And they're like, yeah, we'd love to have you come fight. So I went over there and had a fight. And I don't know if I was going to do it ever again. It was over. I thought it was really fun. But then the people here got a hold of me in America, the BKFC, and they're like, hey, you know, we'd love to have you come fight. And I was like, man, I'd love to. And then I was going to do BKFC one, but then exact same night, my daughter's wedding, you know? So I was like, yeah. Talk to my wife. Think we could move the date. She just kind of looked at me like, yeah, we're not going to move the wedding date. So I was like, man, I can't make the first one, but I will do BKFC two. And like, all right, cool. So I did BKFC two. And then loved it, you know. I was like, man. But at this point, I'm in my mid 40s, you know what I mean? And I'd had wrist problems for years. I hadn't been able to do any push-ups. So then they signed me up for BKFC four. I was like, cool, let's do this. And then they had to get 3 shots of cortisone in my wrist throughout that training camp. And I was just like, man. My doctor's like, you got to have wrist surgery. You know, you can't keep doing this. It's over. So I was like, give me one more shot. He's like, all right, you gave me my last one. Like 2 weeks before the fight, so I could punch still. And then after the fight, had wrist surgery and never really got back to where I wanted to. But I remember, like, after my fight, I was talking to him. I was like, look, man, I love doing this, but I'm like 45 now. I would like to do some commentary. I'm like, I feel like I'm in a unique position. I've had 15 pro boxing matches, I've had, you know, tons of MMA fights, and I've had, you know, 3 pro bare knuckle fights. You know, who else could you have more of an expert than me? And they're like, good point. So they started putting me in the commentary role and freaking loving it, man. So it's been a lot of fun.
How did you find the transition from, you know, fighter to the media? Because you did Fox Sports, UFC, like you just touched on, BKFC with friend of the show, Sean Wheelock. Was the transition fairly easily for you? Or?
I would love to say yes. In some aspects it is, in some aspects not at all. Like I said, what I've learned is doing commentary is just like anything. You get better with more you do it. You know, some people are just natural. They can just jump in right in, and that's not me. I had to try and go and do some lower level MMA and just try to get used to being on the microphone and work all that stuff out and kind of figure out exactly how to do it and what you're supposed to do. Luckily, like I said, you got Sean Wheelock there, who's probably, you know, one of the best there is out there. And, you know, told me some good advice right away, and it just made it work really well. And just working with him all the time, we're getting we got our timing down. And I think we work really well together, but man, I'm just lucky to have a good partner like that. And I hear certain broadcasts, I'm like, they don't really understand what's going on here. I'm like, he's color, you know, or he's play by play and I'm color. So he's supposed to, you know, say certain things. I'm supposed to say certain things. And, you know, it's not his job to give the opinion on what fighters are supposed to do. It's not my job to tell what exactly, you know, oh, he's throwing left hands. He's got pink shorts. That's not my job. That's not, you know, so we each know our job very well. And just took some time to get there. But, you know, very lucky to have someone like Sean to help me out.
You were like obviously supposed to be on BKFC one and you were on BKFC two. Could you see right away how quickly the sport was going to grow?
Man, I thought so because, I bring this up a lot. A lot of times, you know, we talked about it earlier. We talked about there's a lot of money involved now in UFC. You get a lot of these title elimination fights or even title fights or anything. It's a lot about, I got to win this fight at all costs, especially when you got half your pay. So if you lose, so you get a lot of people who are, they're out there to win a decision. They're out there trying, okay, I'm going to out jab this guy. I'm going to hold him down. You know, okay, I've already holding him down for half the round. I'm winning this round. It's going to not. It's an athletic contest now sometimes. BKFC is a fight. It's a straight up fist fight. That's what that is. And that's what it's going to remain, I hope. You got two guys who want to knock each other's head off. I mean, that's the one thing people loved about the early UFC days. People were out there wrecking each other. I mean, they just want to go out there and take the other guy out. It wasn't, I'm going to try and hold this guy down. I'm going to try and win this season. That wasn't there. That's one of the things I think people loved about it. I think that's one thing that people love about this. Bare knuckles, man. People are coming to fight. You know, if you want to watch a really good, skilled athletic contest, we'll get some of those, but this might not be for you. If you want to see people come out there and show, put a lot of heart, energy on the line and want to go out there and take people's heads off, this is your sport. I don't think I've seen anybody who watches one who's like, damn, I want to watch the next one. Everybody likes it after you watch it once. They're very entertaining.
Do you have a favorite? You've been involved, obviously, in MMA, boxing, bare knuckle.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if it's up to me, I'm watching bare knuckle. I mean, I watch boxing. I love watching boxing. I love UFC. You know, I love MMA, but I mean, of all of them, I mean, if I'm going to go watch one, I'd rather watch bare knuckle right now. Be live at an event, probably bare knuckles. Man, it's as good as it gets. You know, I've been to one of the most energetic and energy felt rooms I've ever been at is when, like, Artem Lobov fought Jason Knight the first time. I mean, that thing was nuts there, man. I could feel the tension, just feel the environment. It was so crazy. Man, that was amazing. So, yeah, I think that's where you get the most entertaining fights right now for my money. Plus, I mean, you get that bare knuckle app, it's like $5 a month. And like, you get the whole year for less than one UFC. So, like, it's a great deal. And it's just – I think they're the most entertaining thing out there, really.
Looking back on your career, do you think that you're one of the last real gladiators of the sport and it's now turned into a business?
I would say no. I'm one of them, but I mean, hell, you still got people like, you know, Matt Brown still trying to compete, Donald Cerrone was just, and like, those are the type of guys I like to still watch. Even Robbie Lawler a little bit. I was like, those guys come to fight, man. And those are the kind of guys I like watching. I was in that group, but they're still around. You know what I mean? So anybody who comes and lays on the line, no matter what, doesn't just to go out there and fight. I think a lot of those guys, maybe not anymore, but at one point they'd be doing this if there was no money involved. You know what I mean? Those are the kind of guys I like to see. It's just about who they are as a person. You know, it's like, yeah, I could definitely admit, you know, I did it for no money was involved sometimes. I know some of those guys did too, but a lot of these guys now, there's no way in the world they're doing it. If they didn't get paid well, it just takes but I mean, just when you go into it with expectations, thinking there's going to be money, it's one thing. But when we first started, most of us, there was no real expectation of good money. I mean, never thought that was – I didn't think it was a possibility for the first couple of years. And then it's like, okay, there might be. But early on, you just did it because you love the sport and you love the fight and you love the lifestyle. So nice. Anybody who's still like that, I still like that they're – we're definitely a dying breed, though. It's definitely not the common anymore. We're the exception, not the norm.
Looking back on your career, what are the top three of your favorite fights you've been involved in?
Well, definitely the Dan Hardy one, just because, like I said, the way it ended, you know, I was able to get the fight of the night, the sub, all that stuff. But I was able to kind of bother me about that fight. A lot of people were like, man, well, he's really good on his feet. You need to go out there and try to get him to the ground. I'm like, well, I mean, I don't – you're saying I'm not as good as him on my feet is what you're saying. And I'm like, I'm pretty good on my feet. I'm not going to try and take this guy down, hold him down or submit. I'm going to try and knock his head off. And so I was able to do what I wanted. And he shot in on me with the last minute, and I got the submission. So I love that one. I always really liked a fight I had with a guy named Paul Taylor. Mm-hmm. Fighting him in England. I think we won fight of the night, but that was another one where it was just a grind, man. That dude was tough as nails. We just kind of went there and beat each other up for 3-5 minute rounds and was able to win a decision there. It was a good one. I remember he hit me with this good left hand with about 20 seconds ago in the fight, and just probably saw the ugliest picture I've ever seen of anybody on the internet. It's got my face all contorted, my ears flipped up, there's blood flying out of my mouth, but people put all kinds of memes on there and were making it so funny. But that was a great fight. Are you talking just purely MMA or boxing or anything?
All of them, all of the fights that you've been involved with.
Okay, and probably one of my favorite fights I've ever had all time was one of my boxing matches. A guy named Omar Pittman is, he was a young prospect from Philadelphia. He went out there. Remember early in the first round, we were going at each other. I knew he was younger, faster, and stronger. I remember we bumped heads right there, and I'm bleeding. And so it kind of got me a little wobbly. And then starting the next round, I went up there, and he dropped me with a left hook. And my coach, got up to stop the fight because, my legs were gone. I was wobbly. And they're like, this dude's coming throwing bombs. They're about to stop it. But the other, I had this old cut man, West, and he's like, nope, let's let him see how this goes for a minute. Give it a minute. And I end up just grinding this fight out and end up knocking him out in the seventh round, just wore him down. And that was one of my favorite ones just because I like fights when you got to deal with some adversity. You know what I mean? It's anybody can be bigger, stronger, faster. But, that guy's a better fighter than me. But I just, use my willpower and freaking took his soul, just beat him on will and broke him down mentally. That was definitely one of my favorites. Everybody I've talked to was at that fight who says it was the best fight that I've ever seen. So, just something about, dealing with adversity and overcoming it. I love that. Anytime we're talking, when I'm doing bare knuckle commentary, there's been a lot of fights when people get up off the canvas to win. And that's my favorite. If you get knocked down, you get up and when you win, you're doing something, that was one of the best ones where I had to deal with being almost out a couple of different times, having him rock me and be like, just find the will to hold on and keep fighting till you can win. That's what I like.
Who's the most talented fighter that you've either fought or been in the gym with that didn't actually make it?
There's a guy who was really good. One of my best training partners ever was a guy named Nick Hyde. And Nick Hyde was so talented, man. He came to me first and he saw me fight in Indy. And he was like, man, I saw you guys and I can tell you guys really good. So he came and he started working with us. He was so talented on his feet. He was my number one sparring partner for years. And at first he wasn't any good on the ground. He got good. He's like a black belt in jiu-jitsu now, dude. It's so good all over the place. But his hands are still just pinpoint accurate. Kicks great. He had a few fights. I remember, man, he just did not like the pressure. People don't understand. I've seen it. You talk to people somebody doesn't like pressure. But it was George St. Pierre. He did not like the pressure. They said he'd be in the back being why do I do this? I'm going to just get a normal job. I'm done fighting. Whoa. He would say it. People think stuff like that. He would verbalize it. So a lot of pressure involved. And Nick just did not like the pressure that came with the fight. He just, the nerves. That, 90% of it's mental sometimes. A lot of people can't deal with that. And Nick was as good as anybody as I've ever trained with. I think he could have had, sky's the limit for him. Mm-hmm.
Is there anybody that you would have liked to have fought in your career?
Yeah, when I was on that, when I was on The Ultimate Fighter, I got to train with George St. Pierre. I remember he said when I saw him after you get done with The Ultimate Fighter, you're off for a couple months, before I fought Matt Serra. And he was like, the first time I worked out with you, I told my coach and said, I just worked out with the guy I'm going to fight. I think he's going to win the whole thing, So we had some pretty good training sessions. I thought I'd love to fight him. I love him. He's a super nice guy, but I just thought as a respectful thing, I want to fight the best, And I knew he was really good in talent. That was a fight I always wanted.
It's just the challenge of.
Oh yeah. If you're doing this, why would you not want to fight the best guy in the world? I've always thought, I think he's one of the best. And I just want to see how I would do against him. I know he's very smart, intelligent, tactical. But I just thought something, the way we matched up, I thought it'd been a good fight for me.
I heard a rumor whilst I was doing the research for this that you tried to, or there was talks of you fighting Roy Jones Jr.
Yeah. Yeah, man. I was really, really trying to push for that for a long time. I had 15 pro boxing matches, and when I signed to be on the Ultimate Fighter, I couldn't do any more boxing. So I was like, well, this sucks, because I love boxing. Matter of fact, I was almost on that show called The Contender, where if I'd done that, I wouldn't even probably been able to be on the Ultimate Fighter. So it was that show that had, you know, Sylvester Stallone and Sugar Ray Leonard. They had the first season very successful, and then I did a tryout for the second season, and they're like, man, we really love you, we want to put you on. They're like, only thing is, we're deciding between two weight classes, either 168 or 147. Like, obviously, if it's 147, you can't do it. I was like, yeah. And they're like, so we'll let you know. Well, they went with 147, so I didn't get to do it. So I never had a boxing match again, so I was kind of pissed. But remember, Roy was wanting to fight an MMA guy, and I was thinking, dude, I'm the only MMA guy who's had a legitimate boxing career. I had 15 pro fights. I'd love to do that fight, you know. I was really pushing for it and trying to get it. And I kept talking to people, and they said, I talked to somebody like, I think we got it worked out. And I talked to Rory about this, and it just never really materialized. So I don't know. It is what it is. I got to do some bare knuckle instead. But yeah, I was definitely wanting that fight. I mean, you know, once again, Roy, in my opinion, there's a 10-year period. Roy's by far the best boxer in the world. I mean, maybe one of the best they've ever seen. Just so unbelievably good for about a 10-year period. Nobody could touch it. And just, I was, you know, every time he'd fight, I would watch. So just to be able to go in there with somebody like that to test yourself, oh, what a dream come true that had been, man.
How was getting tasered? I saw that there's a video of you on YouTube.
Yeah. Man, you know, it's funny. I go to a military base. You know, I like to go talk to the military people. They're all super huge UFC fans, and like, they're so appreciative of what we're doing. So I was like, man, it's my responsibility to go thank these people for what they're doing for us. Remember, I'm in there, and they're like, oh, we're just going through with some of our new recruits, doing some taser stuff. Would you like to be tasered? And so I'm supposed to be the tough guy. I'm supposed to be the badass guy. How can I say no? So they kind of, I won't say they pressured me into it, but like, hell yeah, we'll do this. You know, I had to get tough and put these clips on me, and then guy gets on the side of me, like, what are you doing? Like, we're going to fall down. I'm like, this is going to suck. And they're like, it's going to last 6 seconds. I'm like, can't we just do it for 1 second? They're like, no, it's not how it works. You hit it, it goes for 6 seconds. So I was like, all right. It's very funny when they say, okay, you ready? And they kind of point the thing at you, and you're looking at God each side. It's like, damn, what am I doing? You know, it's like, well, I know this is about to happen. Why am I letting this happen to myself? But hey, you just have to do it. And it's amazing. All of a sudden, it's like you get hit with a bat, boom, and like you're trying to, like, your eyes are closed. All of a sudden, I was trying to stand back up, and I was kind of getting up, and I couldn't do anything, man. It was tough, but that was funny.
You have your own whiskey, Lights Out Bourbon.
Yep.
How did that come around? Is that something you've always wanted to do? Did a company reach out to you?
No, man. I have a friend who owns a bar, and you know, he'd done some distributing as well, liquor distributor. And he's like, we're at his bar drinking one day, and you know, always tasting different stuff. This is what I like, this is what I don't. He's like, you know what? He said, we should. He's like, I know people who, you know, can come out with a label for you if you'd like to do that. I was like, man, no, you don't. Like, yeah. So, you know, I'm sitting there drinking. People just talk, you know, nonsense. And so the next day he called me back up and was like, hey, you still want to do it? I'm like, hell yeah, I want to do that. You know, so we started going to different, you know, places. I started tasting different bourbons, and I like this, I don't like that. And finally found this is my mixture that I like. And this was a long time ago, man. This is like probably over a year and a half ago. So then just took time, got everything worked out, and started coming up with it, man. It's been fun. I mean, I just enjoy, you know, I enjoy going out and hanging out and drinking some bourbon, but it's just fun going places and you know, selling bourbon and hanging out with people and talking to people, doing stories, man. It's a lot of fun. So anytime I can do something like that, I'm definitely, it's something that I enjoy doing. It relaxes me. And, you know, I don't sit there and drink 10 or 12 of them. I just sit there and get my big fat ice cube, sip on it, have fun, tell stories. It's a great time, man, but just something I kind of want to do for a little bit. And a guy gave me the opportunity, so I took it.
One question I always like to finish on, for somebody that's listening that wants to follow in your footsteps as a fighter, what advice would you give them?
I always tell fighters, man, you really have to take the most time to focus on your weaknesses. You can't have weaknesses. If you're people go, well, I'm really good at this, but when I get flat on my back, I'm not good. Well, they're going to put you there. You know, you got to work on your weakest point. Everybody wants to go and work at what they're good at. I'm a good kickboxer. They kickbox all the time. That's great. You don't need to work on that as much. You got to work on your weaknesses. You got to take the worst thing you do, and you got to make that at least decent. You at least, it might not be your strong point, but you have to be able to negate what they're going to try to do to you, because otherwise they're going to, when you get to the high level, they're going to exploit that every time, and that's where you're going to be, and you're going to lose a fight, because every time they're going to put you on your back. They're going to keep you on your feet. Or wherever it is that you're not good, you got to make that not a weakness. You have to make it at least, maybe not your strong point, but some there where you can actually compete. So, and that's not what people want to do. They don't want to work on their weaknesses. So then you have to work on the worst part of your game, and you have to do it all the time until it's not a weakness anymore. I know it's going to be very humbling, because you go in there and you're going to be getting beat by guys who aren't as good as you all around. And that's the humbling thing about this, is like, you're going to be, let's say you're really good at kicks. Well, you might be getting hit a lot by guys who you've beaten in a real fight, but you're not beating them now, because all you're working is on your hands. But whatever that is, it's going to be humbling. But this sport's about being humble, man. You got to check that. Your ego's got to be checked at the door, man, because if not, you're not going to make it in this sport. You have to be willing to be humbled. You got to be willing to work on the hard things. And that's the best thing you can do for the longevity of your career.
All right, Chris, I appreciate you giving me just over an hour of your day. If you want to tell everybody where they can find you on Instagram, Twitter, your podcast, your bourbon, everything that you've got going on, the floor's yours.
Sure, man. Just hit me up on Instagram at Chris Lights Out Lido. He's just saying, man, I gave up my Twitter account a while ago. It's so tough. I got hacked into a couple of times on that, had to start a total new one. I just got hacked into a while ago with like everything, Instagram, Facebook. That took me like 2 weeks to get that stuff back. It was so difficult. And I was just like, with Twitter, I'm like, man, I don't even do that stuff. I don't care. I mean, so don't follow me on Twitter. If so, it's probably not me. So Instagram, and I promise if you hit me up, I'll answer you back. And by the way, I got to tell you, you did a great job of your research, man. You did a lot, you know, finding out the Tase and all the other stuff. So thank you for coming prepared and coming. You run a good show.
Thank you very much, Chris. And you can find us at TLR MMA on Instagram and Twitter. And catch us next time. This is The Last Round.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Last Round MMA Podcast. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes and interviews. In the meantime, follow The Last Round MMA on Twitter and Instagram at TLRMMA.